The following is a production of Professor Robert Barnwell. Each episode includes insights provided by the chairman, CEOs, and CFOs of the world's most successful corporations, as well as thought leaders from premier business schools and international consultancies. If you and your team would like more information on corporate leadership and strategic management, or would like to learn more about Professor Barnwell, his research, and how he may be able to assist your company, please visit Professor Barnwell's website at robertgbarnwell.com.
Hello, and welcome to CEO Talk Radio. I'm your host, Robert Barnwell. During the last episode, we spoke with University of Michigan Business School professor Noel Tishy about his experience as head of GE's Crotonville Leadership Center under Jack Welch and the secrets to developing leaders with sound business judgment. This is episode 8, and we'll be joined by consultant and author William Malik. William is the former program director of Stanford University's Advanced Project Management Program and one of the co-authors of Executing Your Strategy: How to Break It Down and Get It Done. William, welcome to CEO Talk Radio.
Thank you.
Well, we're glad that you could join us today. The subject of strategy execution and change management has, and I expect it will remain, one of the principal subjects that we cover here at CEO Talk Radio. Now, in your book, Executing Your Strategy, you and your co-authors identify and outline six basic steps in the strategy development and execution process. Number one, to clarify and communicate, identify purpose and long-range intention, to translate intention into strategy, goals, and metrics, align strategy, culture, and structure. Number four, engage strategy through the project investment stream. Number five, monitor and align project work. And number six, move project outputs into the mainstream. How did this thinking around these six steps take shape and evolve prior to the publication of the book?
Well, thank you for the question. And essentially, the longer story here was a journey that occurred over about 6 years. While I was program director for Stanford University Executive Education Program, and including teaching in the program as well as conducting, you know, various points of industry research on the topic of, you know, this challenge of strategy execution. And, you know, this is not new, as, you know, Kaplan and Norton had brought this up maybe even 15 or 20 years ago in their seminal work on the scorecard. But yet even over 20 years, the same problem was still there. We saw it in, you know, the year 2000. And the question I began to ponder was, well, if the balanced scorecard was supposed to be an appropriate solution for this 20 years ago, why hasn't the metric moved to any degree? So I really began to challenge some of the Stanford professors that were in the exec ed program to begin to discuss, you know, where is this coming from? What are the root causes of failure? What are the, you know, the single points of failure, if any? And through these dialogues and having these discussions about where is it in the system that the problems exist regarding strategy and execution, I began to kind of begin to see some patterns. And some of these patterns were fairly obvious once I began to, you know, kind of shed some light on them. One of them was that it appears that there were systemic problems, and these were not occurring. These same problem patterns were occurring repeatedly in different organizations, different strategies, different cultures, but the issues were predominantly becoming pretty clear to me that we had, you know, if you would, a corporate body kind of issue to kind of take a look at. So our entire thinking process and the evolution of the strategy execution framework, which are the six elements you just talked about, began to essentially emerge. It wasn't in front of us. I mean, it took 3 or 4 years of really thinking about this, studying it, teaching it, having conversations with senior executives coming into Stanford in the program and sharing perspectives as to how they saw the problems in their organizations and so forth. So one of the things that I came to conclusion about and why there were six elements is that one of the big problems that we see in academia is that this topic about strategy execution, number one, is not even really researched at a level of rigor that you find other subjects like accounting, organizational behavior, various elements of what I call the standard topic matters you see in an MBA education. So one of the challenges we have here, first to start off, is that there was not an integrated view of the issues of the organization or the systems that all of these various components are a part of. You know, one of the things, for example, I mean, you see experts in supply chain management, organizational development, finance, risk management, decision making. And while a lot of these disciplines have some rigor of science behind them, a lot of them have not been totally integrated into a, if you would, a holistic perspective about how the strategy, once it's formulated, actually move into the organization. So myself and Dr. Levitt, Mark Morgan, and others, we began to kind of take a systems perspective and look at this. And actually, we coined the term organizational engineering as a kind of metaphor, if you would, for the kind of thinking that an executive or a senior manager would have to actually understand in order to take these six components and actually align them and begin to actually use them in very practical ways in order to execute strategy better, more efficiently, and more effectively. One of the primary drivers behind this framework happens to be an old theory that's been around for a while. It's called contingency theory. And organizational developers and designers will tell you this is nothing new. And contingency theory basically says that an organization must plan and execute all its work around the contingencies of its context. Put in simple terms, you know, do what's most appropriate for the kind of work that you're trying to get done. Well, the problem of contingency theory, which has been around for over 30 years, is that there's never really been a guiding framework of thought, or if you would, organizing principle that you can actually begin to put into place so you can pick relevant pieces together and design a system and design an organization that actually works for you given the strategy that you're trying to execute. So probably one of the most impactful writings that I've come across in the years is by Jeffrey Moore and some of his work, Living on the Fault Line and so forth, and I've quoted him quite extensively in our book, where he began to reveal to me through his writings a fairly profound understanding of some of these elements that make up, you know, the organizing principle, if you would, that would guide the contingent theory about how do you adapt your organization to work better and so forth. And so through this conversations, through this probing of topic matters and the challenges that we see in the business world, essentially the strategy execution framework was born. And the fact of the matter is it was literally done on the back of a napkin in a bar in between a three-day planning engagement that I had at IBM doing one of their annual planning sessions in early 2000s. And from that napkin, essentially began to piece together some of the thinking around the system approach of what strategy and execution is comprised of. And this kind of led for another year of discussion and so forth, and developing more courses in the Stanford Exec Ed program to really kind of bring this together and test it out in the classroom, if you would, and then again testing it in real time in the business world. But that's kind of where it came from. Its genesis took, you know, 3-4 years, and then once we were ready, we had kind of a fairly strong sense of confidence that we could write about it and bring forth an integration of current thought, old ideas, but in a new way, in a new perspective that would provide some value to managers.
You know, I smile at some of our common experiences. You mentioned, you know, the difficulties that you found that companies had in executing strategy. And I really think, you know, companies and leaders don't appreciate the difficulties and challenges inherent in execution. And in fact, I interviewed the CFO of one of the largest corporations listed on the New York Stock Exchange, and the CFO almost slammed the telephone down on the receiver. He was just so disgusted that I would waste his time on discussing really what he felt was basic project management principles as they applied to strategy execution and implementation. And by the way, this is a CFO of a non-investment grade company that has really struggled in the marketplace, probably more so than most these past couple of years. And I'd like to ask, if it's as easy and straightforward as this CFO believes, and I think you and I agree that it's not, why are the failure rates for strategy execution and enterprise-wide change initiatives so appalling?
Well, this gets back to one of my earlier comments. I personally believe, after 30 years of being in the corporate world, spending my first 17 years in planning functions, essentially, new product development, strategic planning, and so forth, and then moving into the consulting world for 30 years, I've come to believe that a smart leader, highly competent in the fields that they have, can be essentially marginalized, or if not destroyed, by a system that they do not understand how to run. Now, when you think about this, one, I think one of the complications in business is that we talk about organizations as though they are there, that they're in some physical concrete thing. Yes, we go to work. Yes, we sit down at a desk and so forth. But the systems and process that guide a lot of the organization essentially are invisible, or the processes have become almost unconscious, and therefore the cultures that evolve, the decision gates and the processes we use sometimes have evolved to the point that you don't know what it's doing to you in the system. And I think Peter Senge wrote about this before, that a smart person in a sick system will get sick, and just the opposite, a marginal person in a well-functioning system will become, you know, essentially effective. And I think, you know, case in point of execution around this, you know, is that, you know, Toyota has demonstrated that they could repeat its capacity for execution and constant innovation because they have a very strong system of leadership development that helps their leaders and managers understand how to run an organization. And if you can understand the Japanese mentality of Kaizen, they're very process-oriented, and I think this is one of the major issues from leaders in the American context have to learn. You know, our DNA is about innovation and fast-moving change and entrepreneurship. This is what America was born on. But execution, to a large degree, is about process. You have to understand the discipline of process as it moves from formulation, strategy, and its formulation to execution. Well, a lot of executives that sit at the board level or the executive level have competencies that are highly specialized, whether it's marketing, legal, financial, and so forth. And while they may add to the formulation area, which I argue is basically it's not too complicated, but once you do get a strategy that is, good to go, the discipline of taking that strategy and operationalizing is an entirely different set of skill sets. And if the skill set is not represented at the executive level, or at least by default into somebody who would be a proxy that's going to be involved with this execution in that management team, you have an interface problem. You have a major breakdown potentially of the challenges in an organization. In fact, Dr. Elizabeth Pate Cornell, she teaches at Stanford, and her basic expertise is in organizational, you know, risk management. And she has very interestingly over the years, where the research has begun to show, and she's fairly passionate about this, that one of the biggest elements of risk and execution is a function of its management team to understand how to manage its interfaces and integrate them. And it's interesting, quite as a matter of fact, I think a week ago, I was watching Hard Talk on BBC, and they were interviewing the CEO of Airbus. I think his name is Tom Enders. And he was asking, this is, what lesson have you learned about the Airbus 380? Which, you know, and as I, this is also in my book, you know, the complications they encountered were just, you know, dramatic as far as planning and execution. It was quite interesting. Tom did not hesitate. He said, the biggest challenge that we have in terms of what we are trying to execute was the issue of integration. Now, this gets back to the issue that Dr. Cornell is bringing up, that it's about the management of the interfaces that happen when you have to integrate disparate functions and skill sets and professionals and so forth. And what we've learned is that the failure points occur at these interfaces. Well, then the question becomes, what do you do at these interfaces? How are they supposed to be looked at from a management perspective? Well, it's quite interesting. Some companies have begun now to actually put into place a discipline, literally a title, called interface managers, whose job is to actually do the facilitation and the integration of the strategies through planning processes and so forth to bring together these global, or I would even argue, it doesn't even have to be global. I've seen companies where the entire intact teams are within one building, and they still have problems understanding each other's roles and responsibilities in the execution, if you would, of their strategies. So I think part of this challenge of these failure rates is indicative in this comment by Tom Enders, who said, we do not understand how to conduct this integration issue that goes on with the work that we do. And I think when you point to that particular area, it opens up a whole vista of understanding about what are the processes that you have to put together in order to deal with this. And part of this deals with the understanding that once strategy is planned, there's another level of planning that you have to do in order to appropriately, if you would, discover how much can be executed, in what form should it be executed in the organization. In other words, you have to go through some integrated execution planning, if you would, as an interim step before you, quote-unquote, operationalize, as you would, budgets or plans and so forth. I think one of the other big problems that relates to this failure from a systemic standpoint is how larger companies go through corporate budgeting. I've run into this in various large companies, which I will remain unnamed at this point since they were past clients, but one of the big challenges is that they said, well, you know, our planning process is de facto our budgeting process. And I said, well, great, well, what's your budgeting process? Well, this year we're trying to negotiate, you know, plus 3% on our budgets, or we're going to be reduced 5%. And by default, the financial planners have marginalized the ability of an organization to recognize that the execution of certain strategies, in many cases, may or may not be constrained by its finance. In some cases, it may have to be completely unconstrained in order to be successful in terms of what they're doing. So this notion of corporate planning, I think, has also a major part in the challenges that we see with regards to execution and why things are so difficult in overall. But I'll leave it at that. And, you know, there's various elements of research that show that it's usually not a single variable either. There's usually four or five major variables that are contributing to this. And if you don't know how to name the variable, if you don't know where the variable is in the organization, if you don't know what process those variables are being driven from, you have a very hard time of trying to isolate, you know, what it is that you have to do in the system to change it in order to be more efficient and effective of execution. And, you know, I'll just raise one, you know, huge issue that I saw, and I used to get this feedback at Stanford quite a bit. Companies with balanced scorecards or supposed performance metrics based on a strategy map, a la the scorecard, had become the problem. There were way too many metrics. The metrics weren't linked to a fundamental value stream, if you would, of the business model, and therefore it skewed the decision processes, and it was in the decision processes and the decision criteria of its management teams became clouded, and they did not know what to do and how to actually do the trade-offs they needed to do in terms of executing. And this is just one. I mean, you could point out, you know, five or six other major things in terms of management management tools and skill sets that actually get in the way with respect to this notion of execution.
Yeah, I'm not sure that Kaplan and Norton would want to agree with that statement, but I would say that, you know, you see the books that Kaplan and Norton have written, and they seem to, since they came out with the balanced scorecard, and it seems to address that very issue. I know they've got a couple of books, you know, on strategy, execution, and the scorecard. So again, whether they would consciously admit that or not, it seems like the progress of their work has been going in the direction of recognizing and addressing that weakness, you know, in scorecards.
Yes, and I'm not trying to cast a shadow on that work and so forth. What I will raise to you is the very fact that if the scorecard is in fact the solution to a major problem, which they purport, for God's sakes, that metric should have changed from 20 years ago that they cited about, you know, 90% strategies are not getting executed and so forth. I mean, there seems to be nobody that can actually rationalize why that number has not moved if, in fact, you know, 20 years of you know, people implementing scorecards would be there. And my point is that if the only tool that you use is a scorecard, you're going to be in trouble as far as understanding the nature and the dynamic of a system that requires more than just a performance management approach to dealing with the issues. I mean, we've seen this. Urbaniak from Wharton brings this up in his book. He says that executives tend to put their nose up in the air to managers who have to understand the basic capacity of project management. They look at it as though this is Joe Two Beers down in the basement that you get paid $40,000 a year to run a project. Well, those are the very people that actually have the DNA of thinking, what we call the project-centric thinking, that are required at the senior management layer to help understand that the processes that you have to have in place that allows a scorecard or a performance management system to actually, you know, achieve what it's in, what the underlying intentions are, is critical. You know, it was Edward Deming who said, if you don't have a process for something you're trying to describe in your organization, you probably don't know what you're doing. And as I've become a little bit older in the game of, you know, doing this, I've actually become to actually believe this, that if you can't describe your strategy execution process coherently and straightforward, with some degree of simplicity, and I'm not saying that it has to be simplistic, you probably have your first opportunity right there. And by describing the process, which would include the elements of a performance management system, be it a scorecard or whatever you want to be looking at, the Six Sigma approaches or whatever, if you begin to look at it from a process standpoint, you can begin to integrate all of the management disciplines you need to be checking. Are these processes included here, yes or no? Is there linkage? Is there interfaces being managed and so forth? And by doing this, I think you have a stronger realization of just how much you truly need to know about an organization to understand how it operates and how new work that comes to a formulation of strategy, especially if it requires new projects, new products, new initiatives and so forth, of how that new work is going to impact the basic portfolio of, you know, current work that is going on in order to actually get what you want into the future. And to me, this is the real power in the realization that this topic is a multiple disciplinary topic. In some cases, I would argue, people would ask me, they come in, they say, hey, you're the expert in strategy execution. Will you come in and help us get this thing going in the next 3 months? I said, are you kidding me? I mean, I said, you got an executive team that's been here for 7 or 8 years, and you're expecting something in 3 months from an outsider. I said, the embedded knowledge of how this business run is sitting right here. What we have to figure out is the system that you're using in order to actually help you get what you want. And this is really the power in understanding the fact that it takes time to truly understand an organization and how it works and so forth. There's quite a bit of work written on the whole notion that culture is a huge part of strategy. You know, I think the different quotes from different people, you know, that culture eats strategy for lunch. Well, if you don't understand how to manage the cultural element, which is the people side and the nature of work and how the people are showing up, you have a major factor there that completely can outweigh every single management approach and practice and best method there is in the book, simply by not understanding how you engineer your culture, how you do this. And, you know, Gerstner was profound at this when he wrote his book, Who Says Elephants Can't Dance? I mean, this is his major epiphany. After, you know, looking back, after he did the change, he said it had more to do with, recombining the DNA of how people thought about themselves in IBM than more than any other thing that had gone on. And so, you know, you look at the challenges of strategy and execution and process, and add all of these management disciplines, and you look at the nature and the profound impact that culture has, you can begin to see that this is not an easy issue. It's not an easy topic to actually come about and deal with.
Now, you've mentioned Airbus, and you've discussed briefly Lou Gerstner's experience at IBM, and the book itself is filled with some really terrific case studies of companies which have both gotten it right and some which have absolutely failed miserably. Is there one case study, either from the book or your own experience, which you think really personifies a company that's nailed the six steps? And can you tell us how and why you think they succeeded when, as you've discussed, so many companies, you know, whether it's, you know, you look at the statistics, 70% or 90% fail?
Great question. You know, I've actually pondered this when we wrote the book, thinking about this. You know, I had the luxury of basically being in front of, you know, probably in excess of maybe 5,000 senior managers and executives who come through the Stanford program, and heard case studies of just major, you know, success. I used to have the manager for the Apple iPod in front of me, and in just profound ways, you know, this is where the student becomes the teacher. You know, she stood up and said, well, we don't do three of the six things you have on your framework, but we do these other three really well. And she would begin to actually explain how at Apple where some areas of process are simply ignored because they slow things down. And in their culture, those decisions are appropriate and make sense for what they're doing and how they actually govern their business. And if you can imagine, you know, their time to market windows for a product are so, I mean, they watch them so carefully because just missing a window by 2 or 3 months can actually mean, you know, major market share loss and so forth. So their notion of speed as far as execution goes changes the way they actually look at these six elements in the framework, where they emphasize some and not others. And this gets back to my point earlier that you really have to know what is contingent? What is going to be adapted? What is relevant to the kind of strategy that you have? Do you understand it? And therefore, what part of the system are you going to optimize in order to allow these, you know, six components to work well? And, you know, to answer your question specifically, I think that, you know, I've seen, if you look at some of the cases that have been written about, and, you know, I bring up Toyota because in some level, they have mastered the notion of continuous improvement through this notion of Kaizen. I think that this has a lot to do in terms of contributing to organizations that learn how to execute, because what they do is by having a high sense of understanding about continuous improvement, their system is able to adjust to this portfolio of project work that constantly comes up that they're looking at in order to improve their product line, their processes, and so forth. And what they're able to do then is on a repeated basis, they become literally organizational black belts of having the system work for them and not against them as it relates to how they go about planning and executing both the major project work they do plus the ongoing continuous work that they need to execute. And arguably, in some cases, in some businesses, live and die by this notion of the continuous improvement that they need to do, not the, you know, the big breakthrough, bet the market strategy to make the company successful. It's the small incremental improvements that actually, you know, drive some of the most profound change on a long-term basis and on a consistent basis. So to me, Toyota stands out in various ways for different reasons about how it executes and so forth. In the book, there is one case in the book that I've had personal experience with, and that's the Singapore National Library, where my company that I ran before actually was involved on the ground with the planning and formulation of the new Singapore National Library, which has actually been there now for 4 or 5 years. But its genesis and how it actually emerged over 7 years was just absolutely fascinating. And the leader of that organization was capable of listening and being open to advice as to how they were going to have to change culture and the systems in order to execute and build probably one of the world's most innovative libraries that, you know, had a very strong digital, you know, footprint in it, and was quite successful. So there are many examples. I wish I had more time to go through the various experience I've had. I've seen organizations where there are pockets of excellence in terms of execution in a department. And despite the fact that the rest of the organization is dysfunctional, there are departments that actually, you know, have kind of carved out, if you would, their own ability to plan and execute the work. And I've seen more of this than I have, if you would, enterprise-wide mastery of the topic of, you know, companies that actually are brilliant in their maturity of execution. But it's you know, it's fascinating when you begin to really look at it as to where you see the success. And obviously, as I mentioned before, like Apple, in certain areas, you talk about, you know, project management process, they look at you as though you were, you know, from another planet, because their orientations of how they actually go through product planning and how the product actually moves quickly, they have a whole orientation that is about just get it done. And the notion of how you actually build light systems or light processes become the dominant factor of how you actually succeed. So, you know, you look at Apple and you can't argue with the kind of success they have with their product lines and how fast they come out and so forth. So anyway.
Well, that get it done philosophy from Apple kind of segues nicely into what I think should be our closing question or commentary. And that's about your concluding chapter, which is entitled Executing Strategy by Doing the Right Things Right. And this chapter contains one of my favorite and often used phrases, which is go fast, go ugly. And I think this would be a great parting thought for our listeners. Why go fast, go ugly?
So this is, you know, this is has become kind of a philosophy of mine, if you would. I was a believer at one point that if you're going to do things right, let's analyze it well, let's lay it down, and really take a very strong, rigorous approach to doing this, very analytic kind of way. And I've been through that. I've re-engineered organizations, and literally, you know, in the 80s, had to go through, you know, went into companies and cut one-third of the workforce and still get the work done, and, you know, right-size, downsize, and so forth. And if you got a couple things wrong, you could put the entire business at risk and so forth. But what I realize is that the basic notion of going fast and going ugly is that we don't want to pretend that we actually know that we have the right solution up front. Now, entrepreneurs will tell you this, that they go on an instinct, they go on a hunch. I think if we do this, we might get X, Y, and Z. that same philosophy is embedded in this statement. We're going to go fast, so let's just go do it. Let's not sit around and analyze 16 levels of Six Sigma data on, you know, this process. But let's try it. Let's pilot the concept. And once the pilot is done, let's review it. If it didn't work, let's abandon it. If it did work, let's figure out how can we do it better. And then, oh, by the way, can we scale this to a larger, you know, part of the organization? And so probably one of the most successful, you know, engagements that I've seen in my career, working from the outside on a consultancy basis, are companies that take this approach of allowing the little seed catalyst change to come in, but in a small way. It's measured risk. We're not changing the entire system, but let's put new ways of planning and implementing strategy, our execution processes, in this area over here, and let's watch it. Let's see how the people react. Let's see what the new tools are, what the new processes are. And by observing the pilot from that standpoint, we can then deduct how well can it actually be scaled across and up and around the organization. And so I think from a standpoint of learning, the go fast, go ugly mentality is really about how fast can we learn. Now, you notice a lot of the business magazines and strategy issues say that in a knowledge-based economy, like the U.S. has become, or a service-based economy, where the real element of competitive differentiation are the people in the organization learning faster than the people in their other companies that they're competing against? And if you're not learning faster than your competition, you are on the Darwinian curve for survival. And if that's the case, you know, you've got to kind of make sure you keep your resumes up to speed and so forth. And we see the kind of speed that has occurred in these markets that we see because of, you know, global competition and so forth. And so I'm a believer that this go fast, go ugly idea, while it sounds kind of, you know, risque and a little bit risk-taking, is actually a disciplined approach to, you know, quickly learning, can this work? Will it work? How can we change it if it doesn't? That allows the organization to begin to pilot its execution processes rather than doing a massive, you know, enterprise-wide change of, you know, the performance management system and the post-formulation planning processes on everything. The idea here is that take a small area and let's see what happens. And by doing this, you get the benefit of not only the learning, but you're actually executing differently. You're instituting change and beginning to watch it. You know, what was it? Einstein says, you know, the insanity is, you know, doing the same thing and expecting different results. Well, this notion here is that let's do something a little bit different in a little bit different area. We may not understand all the elements, but by doing it, we learn. And again, back to the notion of innovation is about how many times can you iterate? How fast are you learning? And by the iteration level, you actually can begin to understand that you're on a journey to getting it right over time. So again, I've become a big believer in this notion of learning quickly about the notion of execution organization is embedded in this topic and this statement.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. William, I really appreciate the time you've taken to be here with us today, and I trust that you'll join us again soon.
Absolutely, and Robert, thank you so much for having me on, and good fortune in all your other shows.
Well, terrific. Now, in the meantime, if our listeners want to learn more about your thinking, tools, and methodologies, where can they go for more information?
Well, the easiest way is to go to my website, which is Strategy2Reality, and that's the number 2.com, strategy2reality.com.
Okay, and then, of course, they should certainly be picking up a copy of your book, Executing Your Strategy, How to Break It Down and Get It Done, which I'm assuming is available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Borders, just about any reputable bookstore.
Yep, absolutely.
All right, again, William, thanks so much, and I look forward to talking to you again sometime.
All right.
That was William Mallett, former program director of Stanford University's Advanced Project Management Program and one of the co-authors of Executing Your Strategy, How to Break It Down and Get It Done. Please join us for our next episode when we speak with Dr. Michael Watkins. Michael is the chairman of Genesis Advisors, an executive onboarding and transition acceleration consultancy located in Newton, Massachusetts. Previously, he was a professor at IMD in Switzerland, INSEAD in France, the Harvard Business School, and the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. During our next episode, he'll discuss the research and framework that underpin his highly respected book, The First 90 Days, Critical Success Strategies for New Leaders at All Levels. Until then, this is Robert Barnwell and CEO Talk Radio wishing you all the best.
We hope that you have enjoyed this episode and found the material of value. To download a transcript of this episode, receive a free subscription to the show, or to learn more about this subject, we encourage you to visit Professor Barnwell's website at robertgbarnwell.com to explore the many executive briefings, presentations, case studies, and other resources available for immediate download. This has been a production of Robert G. Barnwell. All rights reserved.